Hello, welcome to the bonus episode of The Rest Is History, and I am delighted to welcome back the errant Dominic Sandbrook. Dominic, welcome back. Welcome back to Britain. Welcome back to The Rest Is History. Welcome back to the podcast.
Tom,
did you have a wonderful time?
I had a very nice time, thank you. I missed you, obviously.
Of course
very,
you did.
Very, very badly. The sight of your face and that sort of telltale ping of the WhatsApp from Tom Holland, which you the fifth time in a given day wanting to discuss the prospects for the podcast. So that was all very sad, but now I'm back in the country and being reunited with you is just wonderful.
Just heaven. So you were in Sweden for your first week and then you went to Greece, didn't you?
So we went to a place steeped in history. Now obviously talking about your holidays is a ghastly thing to do. I'm not for yourself, but for other people. But we did go to somewhere with a tremendous history. We went to the city of Thessaloniki, which you must have been to, Tom, many times.
Yes.
And it's that weird, so for people who don't know, I suppose it's a bit like Naples or something, isn't it? It commands this bay, and it's a fantastic position. But unlike Naples, most of Thessaloniki was destroyed in a fire in the 1910s. So it's all kind of very, you know, it's all by and large very modern, but then interspersed through all these sort of five-story apartment blocks, there are, as you'll remember, Tom, the most fantastic Byzantine churches. So I very much enjoyed that. And there's the Rotunda of Galerius. So he's a fourth century emperor, mm-hmm. Tom Galerius.
Yeah.
There's his rotunda and his palace. So Thessaloniki was basically the second, it was a competitor to Constantinople, wasn't it?
Yes, and kind of very ancient, really. St. Paul was there. But also a useful base for exploring the Macedonia of Alexander.
Which we did. So we went to, I don't know whether it's Vergina or Vergina, the ancient Aegae.
You have to be careful in pronouncing it.
You do have
it.
To be careful. Ancient Aegae. So it's the necropolis of the Macedonian kings. So they found basically Philip II's tomb. And you can see the treasures that were interred with the Macedonian kings, which are absolutely tremendous.
So you didn't just find it a boring pile of stones, like you did certain prominent features of Roman London in car parks, for instance.
That's correct. Well, it's not a boring pile of stones because the treasures are absolutely fantastic. And actually, one of them that I was really keen to see, they have these golden chests on which is the star of Vergina, which is the source of tremendous contention between the Republic of North Macedonia and the Hellenic Republic in Greece, because the North Macedonians tried to put it on their flag when they became independent in the 1990s, just as they called Skopje Airport Alexander the Great Airport, and they basically tried to appropriate all the iconography of ancient Macedon. So it's fun to see that and to think about, because obviously the Greeks now make a tremendous amount of it, and you know they have T-shirts with it on and all this sort of stuff. So I very much enjoyed that.
Alexander would be so happy about that.
He would be. And have you been to Mount Olympus, Tom? We went to Mount Olympus.
I've been to the foothills. I haven't climbed it.
No, we haven't. I don't think you can climb it unless you're a mountaineer. But what amazed me is they don't make more of it. So we went to this sort of village, basically drove up as high as you can go and then walked up this gorge. But, you know, it was all very sleepy. There weren't coach parties and all the kind of things.
Going to look at the mansions of the gods or anything.
No, it's quite sort of low key.
I think generally Northern Greece is. I mean,
yeah.
Did you get to Meteora?
No. Roger Moore, of course, has been there.
Yeah, of course, that would be the reference point. But kind of monasteries on great spikes of rock.
No, it didn't. And nor did I go to Mount Athos, which is...
Well, you couldn't, could you? Because you had Catherine with you.
I could have gone on my own.
I suppose you could have taken Arthur.
Yeah, we could have done. So,
women aren't allowed on there,
but boys are. I think they. I think there's some rule against in the sort of rubric of Mount Athos. There's talk about not having clean shaved people, meaning women, but they relaxed that to allow clean shaven youths.
Well, because then you could tempt them with the prospect of becoming a monk, catch them young, like the Jesuits.
Yeah, and frankly, I think I'd make a good monk myself.
I think you make a terrible monk.
Do you?
Yes. With your withering scepticism and your impatience with discussion of Christianity. I think an impatience with discussing Christianity is a definite drawback if you're a monk.
I think
unless you're a kind of massively corrupt one.
Yeah, which I'd be. But I'd take a vow of silence, I imagine.
Right, I'm sure you would. Okay, well, on that topic of taking the vow of silence, while you were away, our sister podcast, We Have Ways of Making You Talk, We're holding what I think we're no longer allowed to call Warfest. It was last year. But basically a weekend of festivities themed around their subject, which is, of course, the Second World War. Yeah. And we were not there. We were not present.
I'm not part of that podcast. Why would I be there?
Because it's run by Goalhanger, who are our producers. And apparently they asked you and you said no.
Do you go to all Goalhanger's events, Tom?
I'm sure that I would have gone had you not been away on holiday. I can't remember. I can't remember what excuse I came up with.
Yeah.
but anyway, basically, we didn't go.
No.
And this was a topic of conversation in a remake of the much-loved Downfall parody, which I'm sure everyone listening to this will have seen. But just in case you haven't, it's an excerpt from the film Downfall about the last days of Hitler. And it shows Hitler being told that something awful is about to happen and completely losing it. And it's been done to describe pretty much every major event ever since it came out, basically. Yeah. And obviously the big event this weekend was our failure to turn up at We Have Ways. So have you actually seen, because it was done by Tony, what did you think of it? It's quite good, isn't it?
I thought it was absolutely hilarious. Very witty. Very good. Really sophisticated. Yeah, I was absolutely in awe of
Tony at his best.
Yeah, I thought it was absolutely hilarious. And you can read into that. The listeners can read into that what they will.
Well, I think that the video is going to be posted on the Discord. So people,
there's a lot of bad language in it, Tom.
There is a lot of bad language. So Hitler describes that Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook are total effing traitors and snakes.
It's like the Tory leadership contest, isn't it? It's how they talk about each other. It's like Nadine Dorries talking about Rishi Sunak.
Yes. Yes, dissing his shoes. So that's been the other big topic of conversation while you're away. Rishi Sunak wearing the wrong shoes to a building site. Did you see this?
Well, I saw that she had dissed him for wearing Dorries, who obviously, you know, if I describe her as a serious and statesmanlike figure, that's the same level of irony that I'm bringing to the discussion of the video.
Understood.
She dissed him for wearing an expensive suit and nice shoes. But of course, he's a multimillionaire, isn't he?
Of course he is. And I thought Tories were all about, you know, capitalism. Yeah. And
right. I mean, it's completely mad. I mean, can you imagine Rab Butler dissing Harold Macmillan's Savile Row suit or something, or Douglas Hurd?
Well, it's pretty much obligatory to wear a Savile Row suit, time was. But anyway, Rishi Sunak went on a building site and he was wearing, I think, Gucci loafers that were £450. And so there was huge excitement from the Restless History community that he had been called out wearing the wrong shoes and that his downfall was therefore inevitable. Ironically, it looks as though he is, because he's clearly not going to win. So there you go.
I think we should push back against the shoe business, Tom, because I think this is a terrible sign of the debasement of British politics, that we've sunk to discussing the shoes that people wear on building sites. I mean, it's...
Well, we've discussed the shoes that people wear on yachts. I think
that British politics, that, I mean, it's fine for the Rest is History podcast to be discussing these things, but I think that serious, I mean, this was actually a question in the leadership debate last night about suits and all this stuff. Yeah.
Well, do you want to know just how far the the Tory debate between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss has sunk?
I know what you're going to say, Tom.
Okay.
Go on.
So Liz Truss's co-authored book, Britannia Unchained, Global Lessons for Growth and Prosperity. Mm-hmm. It's her credits, so her footnotes have been excerpted and have appeared on online.
People have been discussing them on social media, haven't they?
They have been discussing them. and basically, so there seem to be two people that Liz Truss has cited. One of them is Matt Ridley.
Yeah.
Who owned, what's its name, the bank that went bust?
He was involved with Northern... I don't know who he owned it. He was involved with Northern Rock and then a columnist for The Times.
He wrote a very, very good book on sex.
Did he? I think it's fair to describe him, Tom. I'm not picking sides, but I think he would describe himself as a climate change skeptic, wouldn't he?
So a man of the right. But just in case you thought that Liz Truss was just a kind of insane right-winger, she's also quoted a top Marxist historian... You, Dominic.
Yeah, so multiple times.
State of emergency.
Yeah.
My popping book on up all over the place.
Yeah. What can I say about this? So Britannia Unchained, which Liz Truss co-wrote with Dominic Raab, Kwasi Kwarteng, and other Conservative MPs, came out in, I think, 2010 at the end of the Gordon Brown period. And it kicks off with a... It's one of those books clearly written by special advisors, not politicians, but they put their names to it. And it kicks off with a discussion of Britain in the 70s.
But surely you could imagine Kwasi Kwarteng writing, couldn't you? I mean, he's a very good historian.
I've reviewed his books, Kwasi Kwarteng. I suppose maybe they did. Maybe some of them they did write it themselves. But it's one of those things where they've put in too many footnotes in an attempt to kind of buttress their argument with the sort of, with some sort of academic credibility or whatever, because they'll basically say things like, because when I looked at what they'd done, they do cite my book State of Emergency a lot, but they cite it unnecessarily. So they'll say things like, there was an election in February 1974. Yes. And then it says footnote 8, Sandbrook, State of Emergency. You don't need a footnote that. I mean, come on. So yeah, I was amused to see that. I was very amused, I have to say. So yeah, that's Liz Truss. Am I a great Liz Truss admirer? I think it's probably fair to say, Tom, I am not. Are you a great admirer of Liz Truss?
I don't really know very much about her.
She used to be Liberal Democrat, would you believe?
I know that now. And she was against the monarchy.
She was a Republican.
And she was a Remainer, and she's now in favour of Brexit. So I do know that. So I hadn't seen the famous footage of her talking, what is it, about pork markets?
Oh, and cheese.
And cheese.
That is a disgrace, talking about importing cheese. That is one of the... I mean, it's one of the weirdest and most painful speeches I think ever given.
So my sense of her was that she was just a bit odd, and I didn't really know anything more about her. Mm-hmm. So I'm educating myself.
Are you? Yeah,
as the kids say.
That's good.
Her. But I have already I've tweeted saying that I'm a keen admirer of her
because you're wanting a peerage or something.
And I've tweeted Rishi as well. So I'm just hedging my bets there.
Yeah, I think you should probably add Keir Starmer to that list, Tom.
I've already done that. Polls. I've already done that, Dominic.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of all of them.
And then Ed Davey for the set.
I don't think he's going to become Prime Minister. I think I can ignore him.
No, okay, fair enough.
So that's all. This is what's been going on while you've been away. And I'm not surprised that you haven't really been paying attention to it.
Oh, God, it's ghastly. It's absolutely... I have to say, when I came back from holiday, we're recording this on Tuesday, we came back on Monday and came straight back to the Conservative leadership debate.
Standard. Did you watch it?
I saw a bit of it just because I'm a nerd. I thought the standard of debate is generally, I think, is abject and always has been. But I thought this was peculiarly dreadful because it's also very vitriolic. They clearly despise each other, which normally is good fun. But in this case, it's just awful. Just awful. I just wish I was back on holiday.
And did you catch up on Love Island? it's apparently absolutely viral this year.
Really?
It's been a great success.
More viral. So I was out of the country when our episodes were broadcast, which I think was probably best.
It's very popular.
Well, it was good. Stanley Baldwin won that vote, didn't he? Which I was
he
very
did,
pleased
with
by.
Theodora.
Yeah. And of course, we're returning to Justine and Theodora.
Your dream combination. But anyway, we shouldn't... We shouldn't discuss Love Island because we did that last week when you were away. We did that with Dom, who did it excellently. So while you've been away, we've had London Week.
Yeah, you were very excited about London Week.
Very, very, very excited about London Week, yes.
And were you happy with the reception? Were you pleased with how it went down?
I think so, yes. Yeah, people seem to have enjoyed it.
Then my favourite bit of that was, of course, Henry Fielding and the Blind Beak.
I know, but did you see?
So it's been done. It's been
done. So we were talking in those episodes about... a rumbustuous drama, 18th century London, Henry Fielding, The Blind Beak, Bow Street Runners, criminals, highwaymen, all that kind of stuff. But apparently, yes, it has been done. So that's essentially, Dominic, is why we are here doing this podcast rather than kind of jetting off to LA,
Los Angeles, exactly. Yeah. But I think in a way that tells its own story, the fact that it's been done and we didn't know about it. Now, that's not just our ignorance. I think it was done and it didn't register. And that tells its own story about the failure of the 18th century or the weird, it's not the 18th century's failure, it's our failure to appreciate the 18th century.
Or maybe it just wasn't done very well.
Maybe, but the 18th century just plays so little part now in the British collective imagination, doesn't it? I mean, the prime ministers are unknown, the events at the Seven Years' War, the great events are completely unknown to the general public. Everybody knows the Victorians and everyone knows who Charles I and Cromwell were. But nobody knows that bit in between. And I think that's so peculiar when it's that, in a way, you could argue that even more than the Victorian period. is Britain's greatest, most golden moment?
Well, I think it's reflected in the fact that probably it's the period of certainly of British history that we have neglected the most on this podcast.
You think? 18th century.
Yeah, I think so. We've done the Seven Years' War, haven't we? What else have we done? I mean,
yeah, you're right.
Not very much else. We've done the French Revolution, but I mean, we've done the Enlightenment.
But we're not British. That's not, yeah.
But that's pretty much it.
We could do the Gordon riots. We could do that. Would be fun.
There's so much we could do, and I think we should.
South Sea Bubble.
Because both of us are very, very interested in it.
Yeah, but I think it's fair to say if you went to the Waterstones, Tom.
Yeah.
You wouldn't find very many popular histories, kind of, you know, credible popular histories of the 18th century that cover politics and sort of diplomatic military affairs, as well as courtesans and coffee houses and stuff.
That is a gap that we should aim to fill. Yeah. I mean, you're right about the courtesans, because courtesans and highwaymen and smugglers. So we did smugglers, didn't we, as well? So they're all very popular. And of course, one aspect of the projected series that we were talking about that hasn't been done is Dr. Johnson chasing ghosts.
That's still open to us.
So that is open to us. I mean, a kind of maybe an X-Files or something.
Well, if we do Dr. Johnson, we'll do Dr. Johnson Ghostbuster, we'll do that on TV. But first, we should probably do a podcast about Dr. Johnson, which we've been talking about doing for ages.
We have. Because he's a bit of a hero for both of us, isn't he?
He is. Yeah, he is.
And Boswell is just the most brilliant character. I mean, actually, so they had periodically, Robbie Coltrane was Dr. Johnson, wasn't he?
And Blackadder, yeah.
No. I was thinking they did a drama about the trip through Scotland.
Oh, did they? I never saw that. And Journey to the Hebrides or whatever it's called.
Journey to the Hebrides. And I think that Robbie Coltrane was, I think, Dr. Johnson, and John Sessions was Boswell. And it was very good.
Boswell. Okay.
Very good. Anyway, so yes, so Dr. Johnson perhaps in the new year. Actually, Dominic, if you remember, we've had an invitation to record it live in Dr. Johnson's house.
Yeah. More convenient for some than others, Tom.
that as may be. Just a shame that Dr. Johnson didn't stay in the Midlands, isn't it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Insisted on coming to London. But it's well worth it because it's one of those few houses that has a statue of a cat outside it.
That's a pretty niche claim to fame.
But so it has Dr. Johnson's cat Hodge.
Okay, very good.
Think we should aim to do that. Anyway, so some comments. People have asked what they would like to record. I mean, we'd actually discussed this a bit with Dom last week, but how did you find the recording of it? I mean, a lot of energy has gone into worrying about your footwear, going back to the topic of shoes.
I think it's fair to say I wasn't wearing the wrong shoes. I was wearing the right shoes.
But you were doing the wrong thing.
But I was doing the wrong thing because I was doing an event that evening for which I had to wear a suit. So I was wearing, obviously, my suit and smart shoes, which were new. Now, the shoes would have been no issue whatsoever if I'd just been doing the event, but because we were doing the walks, the smartness of the shoes and the novelty of the shoes
Dominic,
wreaked havoc with my feet. I wasn't going to bring a spare pair of shoes for your benefit, Tom.
I mean, that's like the Kaiser saying, well, if I was wearing shiny black boots to invade Belgium, that would be fine. But he was on a yacht. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, a lot of women made the point that when they come up to town and they have to walk, they will keep their high heels in a bag and wear trainers.
Well, I didn't bring any high heels. That's true. But I think the difference between us is that for you, that day was about London, was about the walks through London. Whereas for me, that day was about the evening engagement. And there was a bit of strolling beforehand to be done with you and the team.
It's about multitasking.
It was very jolly to record. We did go to an Italian restaurant, which Jack or Dom is.
It was rather grim, wasn't it?
To mention an Italian restaurant that appeared to be from 1972.
That was definitely inhabited by ghosts.
Yeah, it was. We were the only people in there, I think. Yeah. Is anybody interested in this? I mean,
no. Anyway, so let's get on to what Stephen Clark has to say. Who's always a very wise, shrewd observer, and he says that it was a great set of episodes.
Well, that's good.
So that's excellent to know, isn't it? And he says that what gives the Restless History the edge over other leading history podcasts is our confidence in playing around with the format. Other cities to do walking specials on in the UK: Oxford, St. Albans, Liverpool, York, Edinburgh, Europe, Dublin, Hamburg, Berlin, Vienna, Budapest, Athens, the United States, New York, Washington, Boston. Well, I mean, basically, we could. It's a format we could apply to almost
St.
any
city. Albans is a bit the outlier there. I mean, is St. Albans a name to conjure with in the same way that Vienna and Budapest?
Oh, I think so. Verulanium, so the Roman city. You've Maybe. Got the Ver flowing through it, which is apparently so. The waters are so toxic that the ducks have caught bird flu 4 years in a row. So that's fun. There's the oldest pub in Britain.
Okay.
Which they've just shut. There's the Battle.
Okay, you're really selling it.
There's Britain's first Christian martyr.
It's not Founder Siecle Vienna, though, is it?
I mean, no, I'm not saying
it's
is.
It's not walking along the Ringstrasse.
What I'm saying is that there is material there to work yeah. with.
Okay.
Andrew McAvoy, yeah. I would have to visit the Mithraeum in London. You will. It's great. Is it true that they moved it from its original location that Michael Bloomberg bought it? It is basically true, yes. So they found it in, I think, 1954 when they were digging. They were building. They were digging out the foundations by the Walbrook to build. I think it was a house, a kind of company base for an insurance company. So about as un-Mithraic as you can imagine. Although maybe not. I mean, probably people who work in insurance companies would have been
would have Mithraists. Been right because yeah. it was yeah. the Mithras cult was for people on the way up, wasn't it?
So anyway, so they found it, and as with pretty much everything. That they find in the City of London, archaeological finds are a massive pain. So they moved it. They built, I think it was Bucklersbury House, I think it was called. And they moved the Mithraeum to Queen Victoria Street, which was a very, very busy kind of artery through the city. So absolutely choked with exhaust fumes. And they plonked it down on the pavement. It was the early 60s. And they gave it crazy paving. So it looked like an early 60s shopping centre with a kind of few odd blocks
Sounds
chucked
great.
In. And it was definitely there when I first, you know, started walking around looking at Roman London. And it was the biggest letdown imaginable.
Oh, Tom.
And then Michael Bloomberg, the Bloomberg company, bought where this insurance company had knocked it down, built their own centre, and they moved it back to directly underneath the Bloomberg Centre. So the original spot where it had been, and I think it's been done brilliantly well, and it's one of those renovations that gives international capitalism and the international media a very, very good name.
It has been done well. I haven't listened back to that Roman London episode, and it's a long time since we did the walk. But I note from some of the feedback that I was perceived to have been sceptical, and I probably was quite sceptical about some of it. But that was very good, the Mithraeum. I recommend it to people. I think they should all go.
Well, I think people particularly felt that you failed adequately to convey the astonishing spectacle that is the chunk of the Roman wall in a corner.
Oh, that was terrible. That was absolute.
It's not terrible. It's an incredible sight. And loads of people went down and said, wow, that is amazing. Dominic really gave no impression at all.
Loads,
but
Tom,
I think
two,
five,
one.
Six.
That many?
Maybe
really?
Seven. Quite,
that
a,
many?
Quite a lot. Quite a lot.
I think I've seen a lot of Roman walls in my time.
Yeah, but not in a car park, not in an underground car park. That's what makes it distinctive.
It does make it distinctive, but I don't think it makes it especially good. I think that's where we differ.
I think that by that point, the blood was welling up through your leather.
No, it wasn't.
You'd lost all sense of fascination with the past of our great capital.
Right.
I felt you were flagging by that point.
Rubbish. Let's move on. So one of the things we talked about was the Two Eyes Coffee Bar. If you remember, Tom, Old Compton Street, and the history of Skiffle and Cliff Richard and all that sort of business. And one of the things we mentioned in passing was milk bars. And Abigail Munsey says, A Clockwork Orange is the only place I've ever seen a reference to milk bars, and I assumed it was made up. So I think it's called the Corova Milk Bar. Is it in A Clockwork Orange where Alex and the Droogs meet and sort of plan their escapades and so on? But I think they're drinking... Are we meant to believe they're drinking alcoholic milk in A Clockwork Orange? I'm not sure. But actually, interestingly...
So a bit like the Mongols.
Fermented mare's milk. Yeah, very nasty. But so there was some discussion on Twitter, I think, about milk bars after that episode. And somebody pointed out, I can't remember who, so I apologize for not getting the credit right, that they did come from Australia and that people drank milkshakes rather than actual
just milk.
Plain milk.
That would make sense.
And that also they were very much a kind of teetotalers thing. So they were an antidote to, you know, saloons and bars and things, which obviously makes sense.
Would you get coffee there?
I don't know. I guess you might. I think there's probably some, certainly in the 50s in Britain, there is some sort of grey area with milk bars and coffee bars.
Right.
And sometimes people use the terms in the 50s and 50s kind of novels and things slightly interchangeably. But I think what's maybe interesting about milk bars is if they do originate in interwar Australia, that is, of course, the period when you've got prohibition in the United States. And teetotalism, sort of the anti, the demon drink, is quite a big force, not just in America, but across the sort of English-speaking and indeed the sort of Protestant world. So I suppose you would say that milk bars are part of the same movement as things like Cadbury's chocolate or Fry's chocolate, well, founded by Quakers or nonconformists to try and get workers away from drink.
Which then makes it a wonderful irony that this is the birthplace of British rock and roll.
Yeah.
Sex, well, and drugs and milk bars.
It, but you can have rock and roll without boozing. You could be a teetotal rock and roller.
Are there many?
I don't know. I haven't really...
I don't think so. I think you have to have drink and pills, and I mean, isn't that the whole point?
I think it would be. I would be very interested to know if there were
tabs
teetotal
of acid.
If there were teetotal pop and rock stars.
I suspect Cliff Richard. I mean, Cliff Richard, you could imagine being.
He's not a man whose rider calls for, you know, a bottle of Jack Daniels.
No, but I mean, isn't that the whole point of the 60s? Is that they're reacting against that kind of clean cut?
Yeah, of course, and to some extent, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, so while you've been away, there've been some very good interviews with the Rolling Stones.
Saying what?
So Keith Richards. I mean, he wouldn't have been a man for a milk bar, would he?
No, he certainly wouldn't. He said, "You know, Tom, we've never done. Have we done a podcast on the 60s?
We did a live event.
We did a live event on the 60s. But I think we could do a sort of series at some point on the 60s. I think sort of two or three episodes.
We were in London, weren't we?
We were, and we didn't do it. But I don't know whether we do Britain the 60s or the 60s kind of globally. But obviously, I mean, it's actually my first books sort of that were successful were on the 60s. But I haven't really thought about it or talked about it for ages. So it'd be fun to revisit.
Yeah, well, let's do that. So much to do. We've got that, Dr. Johnson.
And you know what else I noticed somebody lambasting us about while I was away? That old favourite, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Oh, yeah, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Which we promised to do about 2 years ago, and we've never...
Well, we will. We will.
Yeah, we will. We absolutely will.
I mean, there's so much history, isn't there? There's too much history.
For our 10,000th episode, we'll do the Polish-Lithuanian. Because do you know what? I bought a book on it about 2 months ago, a massive book on the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Have you read it?
No. No, I've barely. I looked at the pictures when it arrived, and since then I haven't. But it looks a tremendous book. It's about the decline of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
So we don't just want to do the decline.
Well, I think there's a series there, isn't there? Rise, apogee.
I don't know anything about it.
Well, let's do the last question.
But I will,
because that's from Lurkio. Lurkio says he's reflecting on the Battle of Stalingrad, which is our most recent release.
Yes. Yeah, so you'll have had both episodes of that we've done that are going out this week already.
And Lurkio says, Stalingrad to him or her proves that war is ultimately decided by willpower. And he thinks Stalingrad is the proof of that.
I'm just taking a hunch.
Gives the example of Rome and Cannae, France in the First World War, Russia in 1942. The willingness to endure suffering buys you time to do what's necessary to win. And then he gives the examples of the Persians in the 4th century, France in 1940, or the USA in Vietnam. If you don't have the willpower, then nothing else matters. I think that's not entirely true, actually. I don't think it's just about willpower that decides whether you... Because, I mean, Carthage presumably had all the willpower in the world in the Punic Wars, particularly when they were up against it, but that didn't avail them. I think wars
availed them naught.
It did avail them naught, Tom. I think wars are political events, and you need to ally means and, you know, your kind of, you know, means, resources, and political strategy for success. And I think if you lack...
And trucks.
You need the trucks. But, for example, the USA and Vietnam had all the trucks and logistics in the world, but they didn't have the willpower, but they also did. It's not just about the willpower. It's about having a political strategy and an end game and an exit strategy and so on. And I think you need all those things. This is sort of your brother's territory. Maybe we should have gone to
I'm learning a lot from you.
We should have gone to that field in Bicester.
Master of strategy.
Where do they do it? They're in Bicester? We have ways?
So. Yes, I think so. Near Bicester.
God, so glamorous. So glamorous.
That's where you live, isn't it? Your neck of the woods?
I don't live a million miles away from Bicester. I don't know, Tom. When you see those photos from the We Have Ways Festival of those trucks lined up in a field and Al Murray and your brother and a lot of people who look like Al Murray and your brother congregating en masse with their tubs of real ale, did you feel a deep tinge of regret that you weren't there?
I didn't this time because I was playing cricket at Broadhapeny Down, which is the cradle of cricket. So it's one of the oldest cricket pitches, by some measure, the oldest cricket pitch. So that's what I was doing. And I think I'd rather have done that.
Yeah. I would rather.
Than pretty much anything else.
Have been swimming in the Aegean than...
I think that's also a reasonable position to take. Yeah. However, as you know, I've become a lot more interested in the role played by trucks in the logistics of the Second World War than I was before I listened to the excellent episodes done by We Have Ways on Operation Barbarossa. So I'm sure I would have learned a lot.
Well, Tom, I hope you enjoy it next year in that field in Bicester. And I look forward to hearing how it went.
Well, on that note of radiant positivity, it's so good to have you back. Thank you very much for listening. What have we got coming up? We've got Plague in the Roman Empire, haven't we? Coming up next week.
We do.
And we have Pigeons.
Very exciting. Very exciting. And after that, we have Lady Jane Grey will be making her podcast debut, along with
Justinian Theodora.
The Emperor Justinian and Theodora returning in glory after her victory in Love Island for a discussion of 6th century Constantinople.
So that, and we have Rana Mitter on the war between Japan and China, which kind of bled into the Second World War.
And one last note for you from Dom, our producer. He wants to remind you, those of you who are Athelstans, that the Athelstan quiz is tomorrow night. Well, tomorrow for us, so it's...
No, today.
Wednesday
this
night.
Evening.
Yes. Okay. Well,
if you're listening to this first thing.
I've completely lost track of where we are. It's on Wednesday evening.
The 27th of July.
Dom says, do RSVP if you haven't.
And the questions are demanding, but answerable.
Oh, they're brilliant questions this time. I'm very excited.
I've redone mine.
Have you?
Yeah.
Why? Your questions are great.
No, but I think some of them are a bit difficult. So
They were difficult.
I've made them more accessible.
Oh, maybe Tom, you should release for a small charge.
Yours are very difficult.
For a small charge, you should release your deleted scene. Yeah,
yeah,
the director's cut of the quiz.
I might do that. I might do that. Yeah. I might save that up for tomorrow.
And Tom,
if there's a tie break.
You seem a very good fettle, and I'm just wondering, does that have something to do with your consumption of Athletic Greens product?
It did. Honestly, if you'd seen me on Broadhapeny Down,
really?
A surging force of health and testosterone and vitamins and whatever else they put in.
So the fans won't know, the club members won't know what this refers to, because of course they don't get the adverts, but we've got a new sponsor, which is very exciting for us in the normal stream, which Tom has been taking very seriously, which is this sort of sports supplement product.
Yeah,
that I know means an enormous amount to you, Tom.
It does. It does.
Right. That's basically for advertising. We're not meant to be doing advertising on the bonus episode, so we'll shut up about it. So we will see the Athelstans for the quiz. We'll see the rest of you when we see you for Pigeons and Plagues and so on. And
Pigeons and Plagues.
Pigeons and Plagues. And then, goodbye.
Bye-bye.